many talents and roles. Jule Jackson McCabe is best known within the feminist community as a progressive, ardent feminist, an organizer, and a coalition builder. She's the founder and chair of the National Coalition of 100 Black Women, which has grown since its birth in 1981 to a membership of 7,000 women in 25 states. The coalition has served as a leadership forum for professional women, as a conduit for articulating black women's interests to significant corporate and political actors, and as a creator of programs and resources for developing the leadership potential of young African American women. Jule Jackson McCabe speaks her mind even when what's on her mind is not universally popular. I guess she's not running for the President of the United States. For example, the National Coalition of 100 Black Women was one of the first and largest black women's organizations to publicly support Anita Hill, and Jule Jackson McCabe has been a leader among African American women in being critical of Louis Farrakhan and the Million Man March. As if all this were not enough, Ms. McCabe also holds down more than one day job. She is president of Jule Jackson McCabe Associates, a management consulting firm specializing in communications. She sits on a variety of corporate boards and the boards of several institutions of higher education, including her alma mater, Bard College. A good place, but not to be confused with Barnard College. She's been appointed to a number of government commissions, including the New York State Council on Fiscal and Economic Priorities, the United States Holocaust Memorial Council, and she's also been the chair of New York State's Job Training Partnership Council. Her efforts to build communications between public and private sectors and among different groups of people is the consistent theme of all her work, along with a commitment to expanding opportunities and equality. As she'll talk about today, Ms. McCabe is committed to finding ways to cross boundaries and form new creative coalitions in pursuit of those goals. Her talk today is entitled Boundary Crossing Leadership, a 21st Century Reality. Please welcome Jule Jackson McCabe.
Thank you, Leslie. First thing, I'm going to put this speech away and talk to you. Because you all have probably demonstrated the greatest tenacity that I've known in a long time. Because I was with my father, who is a wonderful African-American man, who did produce an African-American female feminist before I came over. And he said, Jule, do you think anybody's going to show up? And I said, well, sweetie, I've talked to 5,000 and I've talked to five, whatever it is. I've got some kind of message I'd like to articulate. I always listen to the person who is introducing me because my resume sort of is very strange because I was a woman who always wanted to be able to dance on many sets and have felt sort of frustrated from time to time and not being able to inspire enough women to want to take on the challenge of dancing on many sets, of understanding what the games are and how to play them in order to be empowered, in order to make a difference in the lives of women, and especially young girls and the young generation of feminists who will be coming forward. Mine was an exciting beginning because I talked to Leslie for about 2 seconds on the way over here, and I asked her about Ruth Mandel, and she said very laudatory things about Ruth. And Ruth is not an African-American woman, I hope you know. And her dear friend Edith Schmertz is also not an African-American woman. And back in the early 70s, I had the privilege of working with these two women when they were setting up at Rutgers, at Eagleton, the Center for the American Woman in Politics. And I was one of those sisters at that time that came from a very bourgeois background that felt that the white women had all the privileges, that felt that this was some kind of indulgence of a few intellectuals, and that this real struggle was that around race. Now, at the age of 51, having been inspired by Ruth Mandel and Edith Schmertz, having organized in 20 states in 10 months in 1981, having 7,000 activist women who for once and for all are finally calling themselves black feminists, I can say to you that I understand the varying struggles that we go through in a racist, sexist, classist society that still has to come to grips with all of those isms on a daily basis. Part of our responsibility is to relive, whether we're talking about Janet Rankin or we're talking about Ida B. Wells, we're talking about tenacious women that understood that they had to be courageous. And about 5 years ago, I started to think about what the new challenges of my generation of feminists would be, and I came up with something quite simple, and that is boundary-crossing leadership, because over 30 years, I have been involved in all kinds of institutions and organizations. I have been involved with institutions and organizations that are led only by white males. I've been involved in organizations and institutions only led by black males, populated by African-American women, supported by African-American women, financially, emotionally, spiritually, and every other which way by African-American women. I've also founded an organization and worked with women of color. And there is something that is stagnant in dealing with sameness all the time. And part of the deal that has to be cut in this society, if we're going to deal with a global marketplace, if we're going to deal with a 21st century reality, if we're going to deal with technology and the issues of math science for our girls, math science for all of our minority poor children, if we're going to deal with globalization in a healthy way, if we're going to fight back this anti-immigration attitude that reminds me of the Dred Scott decision of 1857, if we are going to do those things, we have got to stop trying to like each other, love each other, but learn how to work for mutual respect so that we can have boundary-crossing leadership, so that a Marion Wright Edelman, for example, and I have sour grapes over not getting the NAACP, so I'm going to beat up on a lot of people for a minute because I just feel like doing it. All right. See, Marion Wright Edelman can write the public policy and can institutionalize an advocacy center for America's 60 million children, but she could never head up the NAACP or the Urban League. Did you get it? Condoleezza Rice could be Soviet affairs advisor in a Bush-Reagan administration, could be provost at Stanford University, but she could never lead the NAACP or the Urban League. Faye Waddleton could head up the advocacy, brilliant advocacy, of the choice movement in America, but she could never be the head of the NAACP or the Urban League. So that part of the responsibility, as I have said to Reverend Jackson, a friend, not a colleague, think about that. That if he is going to roll out the women's movement when it is convenient for him, and if he is going to call on the leadership of now when it is convenient for him, that he needs to put the feminist agenda from the eyes of minority women in particular, but all women specifically, on the civil rights agenda continually. And I say to my feminist friends who are leaders who are white the same thing. Because the racism within our society permeates also the feminist movement. You know, it's always amazing to me, I always say this about all of us, that white women and white men only want to hear what they want to hear. So oftentimes when they talk to their people of color, their friends that are people of color that are male or female, we have to continue to talk until we say what they want to hear before there are partnerships. Well, in boundary-crossing leadership, we have to start to respect the set of experiences that one has through their cultural environment. For me, it was a long time I was the public relations officer for Governor Hugh Carey for the women's division. For a long time, I didn't understand the plight of white women that were middle class. because our experiences were so different. Middle-class black women always knew they had to work, always knew they had to learn how to read and write, knew that they were going to be supplemental and co-equal earners within the family structure. Middle-class black women always knew that they may have a sister that was on welfare and one that was a doctoral student at Harvard. Middle-class black women, well-educated, may not know the right fork to eat with at first. So the unevenness of the African-American experience in our society has made us different, not better than, but different. And those differences have to be laid out. Those last taboos have to be put on the table before we can collectively come together as women, white women and women of color, in order to do business. We can't talk about the ultimate boundary crossing leadership until we fess up about our own stereotypes, about our own hang-ups. It's an interesting experience. It is one that is often rejuvenating. It is not a negative experience. I see some faces out there like, where is she going to take us? The reality is that we are in a global marketplace, that we are suffering rollbacks and ceilings like we have never before. And many of them are invisible because they are so sinister, these men. It is being played out dramatically to the point that they will pay probably dearly on November 5th, but the Republicans have just wiped out women. The feminist issue does not exist within the Republican agenda. And it's really amazing. I mean, when Tanya Milich, who I first met when I was in my 20s, and we're both in our 50s now, and I'm still sort of hung up over that. I was always a young woman. And I don't know what the hell happened, but you know, we're trying to hang in there, those of us that turn 50 this year. This is like a real trip. But Tanya Milich had the courage to challenge her party. Now, those of us that are politicians know that both of these candidates are whores, flat out whores. Now, I will talk about whore number one, the best communicator in this land. That's William Jefferson Clinton. This man disturbs me because he comes to you with all of his eloquence, with all of his savvy. I have a Jewish friend that told me one day, she called me up, she said, Jewel, I just came from a meeting with Bill Clinton. I think he wants to be a Jew. I said, Mona, why did you say, what the hell are you talking about? Jewel, I'm telling you, he's in it. When we talk, I mean, tears come to his eyes. I said, sweetie, go to a Baptist church with this man. Let some big black woman stand up and sing. I said, he will sit there and you will see tears flowing down his face. He wanted to be black that day. We have got a chameleon and a person that has wanted to make it so bad in society that he stands for nothing, but he does carry the symbol of progressive liberalism. And if enough other reason, some people will vote for that, and I don't put that down. What I have a problem with, you see, because I'm a friend of Lonnie Grenier's, and I use her experience not as just because she was an African-American woman, and by the way, one of his African male henchmen cornered me one day and said, why don't you keep your mouth shut? And I said, if Thurgood Marshall had this administration to strategize his appointment to the Supreme Court, we would have never had him, and this African-American man who will go nameless, whoops, I may go through this crack, said to me, well, Lonnie is no Thurgood Marshall. I said, we will never know, will we? I'm a strategist. I was waiting for the strategy to come from the White House. I didn't do anything with our troops. I was waiting for someone to say, where are we going to put the positive spin on this woman? I was waiting. So my problem is I know too much of the treachery. However, the bigger picture may be the symbol. But I have a real problem when a politician, and I'm a strategist, I don't mind what we have to do to win if you are committed to an agenda that is about progressive change in our society. And progressive change is inclusive. And it deals with the isms of this society. And it opens up this mainstream America to all for equal pay, for child care, for reproductive health rights inclusive of choice, for gay and lesbian rights, for all of those issues that America should stand for. I have a passion because I come from a people that came here in 1619 as three-fifths human beings, as chattel, who were punishable by death if they learned how to read and write. That was 377 years ago. In 246 years, we lived as three-fifths human beings. And we were punished by death if we learned how to read and write. And we lived through Dred Scott. And we lived through Plessy versus Ferguson for another 100 years. And we did have the Supreme Court with Constance Baker Motley, one of the co-founders of the movement with Thurgood that changed the face of the Supreme Court and its decisions. And I bring up Connie because you never hear about that. It's like you hear about Frederick Douglass, but you don't hear about Ida B. Wells. If it hadn't been for the journalistic scholarship of Ida B. Wells, the journalist who chronicled the lynchings in Memphis, you would not have had a Frederick Douglass. So certainly you would not have had Thurgood if you had not had the scholarship, the tenacity, the wisdom of Constance Baker Motley. Know those histories. It is important. When you hear of the optimism of African-American people, it's because we came here not as running from politics. We didn't come here with a village to go to or a neighborhood to go to. We didn't come here being received or as wealthy immigrants as we have today. We don't want to be better than anybody, but we do expect, having worked the territory of these great United States, to continue the affirmative action and the spirit of affirmative action as it was so designed. Now, I say that passionately so that you understand my frustration with a William Jefferson Clinton, even more so than a Bob Dole, because I know what I got with Bob Dole. I truly do. I can have an agenda to fight Bob Dole. I can organize. I can enlighten people. We can make a difference. We did it. The Constitution and its founding fathers, the ideals were brilliant. The sexism and classism was rampant. The people who have died to free us all, for us in this century, we women, to get the vote, the amendments to the Constitution, the process works. But if you have a fraud in the White House representing democratic politics in the best sense of the word, how the hell do we know what we're going to get in the next 4 years? How the hell do we know what will happen with Al Gore? What kind of compromise freak he may become? Now, I don't say that to tell people to go out and vote for Bob Dole. I'm not there. And if Jack Kemp uses another sports metaphor, I think I will be ill. I mean, he doesn't get it. He is so out of touch. Everybody's talking about he's the youngest 61-year-old. If anybody black in this room knows, and maybe a few enlightened white women, let me tell you something. When he went to Harlem, he rolled out, now you know where I'm gonna come from, he rolls out some of the oldest people, and I'm not an ageist now. I can't afford to be. I know what I'm facing. But you can have old ideas and stagnant ideas and be in your 20s. Here he rolls out Lionel Hampton, that's got to be 91 years old. And I love Lionel Hampton. He is a friend of my father's, trust me. But there's no way you're gonna energize a black community with Lionel Hampton up at Sylvia's. I said, what kind of patronizing confusion is this? And I love fried chicken, don't get me wrong. It's part of a cultural thing. But we've got fools. I said to Leslie before, I said, you know, if you let white men run around long enough, their survival skills will just totally atrophy. Now, Clinton is sort of a redneck, so he knows how to kick butt, he knows how to survive, but these other boys, they've been out there so long, they're like the cops that couldn't shoot straight. Have you read the paper? They make the, I said, at least give Clinton something to run against. You know, we may get so lazy because this crowd is so dumb. You figure they come out of the Republican convention, you figure they know that they've got to get the women's vote. I'm not even going to talk about Kemp talking about, before Colin Powell gets up there. Now, Colin Powell's one of the best public speakers I've ever heard. Now, I don't know how many in this room have ever heard it before, but that was he's one of those that even when he's bad, he's good. That nervous speech that he gave up there, I said, would you look at how nervous Colin is today? His glasses were a little half-cocked, because he knew that this was fraudulent. But once they came out of there, don't you think that Liddy Dole, who personally, I get caught up in, I love greatness. Now sometimes I will not compromise my ideology. And let me fess up right now, I was a Paul Tsongas Democrat, okay? And that's really where I come from. I come from a whole bunch of fiscal realities and a progressive liberal domestic policy. So, and that's always confusing to people. But I do believe that you can do both. But I sat and I watched Newt Gingrich stand up at the Republican convention and say that the greatest American who ever lived, the greatest leader, came from Georgia, and his name was Martin Luther King. Well, I said to myself, now I know I'm losing my mind. Both conventions were like soap operas. They were very, 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 very revealing and frightening. Because as we talk about a global marketplace, we're not getting manufacturing back in this country. You know service sector is driven by women in this society, and you know that 80% of the service sector are women, and you know that we represent less than 3% of management, of ownership. You know that we are electing fewer women, and the women that we're electing are not feminists. I don't know, and I hope somebody challenges me, one black woman that's elected to office that's a feminist. I wish you would challenge me. I would, and a few people said, well, when I came out against the Million Men, you would have thought the Million Man March. One positive thing happened. Spike Lee's gonna make a lot of money because I hear that this movie is quite fabulous, this get on the bus thing. So, and Spike needed something positive to happen in his less than stellar career. And by the way, since I'm into movies for this moment, Whoopi Goldberg's Associate will thrill you. It is a feminist, it is comedy, but I wanted to stand up and cheer. She told my whole story, so please go see that. But last year when I came out against Louis Farrakhan and Angela Davis came out, you could not have had more odd fellows than Jule Jackson McCabe and Angela Davis, trust me. We love each other, we respect each other, but I am a flat out capitalist. You get it? And I'm clear about it. I'm also a flat-out feminist. Now, I wasn't attacked as much as I got more attacks from one of my chapters, the 100 Black Women. I'll tell on myself. I have 62 chapters, and they are perceived in their communities in different ways. From sort of activist women, they probably are perceived as bourgeois black women. I perceive them as the way black women always have been. Undercover, doing what they have to do in a network to make things happen on behalf of their community and themselves. But I had a chapter in Boston of women from the academy. Have I done 30 minutes already? Oh, we don't want anybody to, oh my God. All right, yeah. This is okay. I mean, let me just finish. What the hell was I saying? I was talking about Angela. What? Well, my boss and child. Now, I really want to tell you seriously about what happened to Angela, because it's probably more important than what happened to me, but I have women that I love with a passion who will follow me even when they're not sure, who followed me with Anita Hill, when African-American women who usually, if we stand up, we're met with naked hatred by African-American, naked hatred. Cut out your heart and watch it beat. Hatred. I'm serious. You all don't know about naked hatred. Because if you have black men that may have one paycheck more than you, and they think you are the enemy because they are misguided, trust me, in this patriarchal society where they are as confused as we all are, by the way, because we all have some scars from this sexist, racist, classist society, black women that have the nerve to stand up and say, validate my opinion because I have earned it, I met with naked hatred. Well, anyway, my chapter, I had one chapter that defected. Now, these women, they're up in Boston. I mean, I'm talking about women with great, all kinds of great titles and everything. I found out what they did. First of all, they denounced me, their founder, in the newspaper. I thought they had lost their mind because I have an ego, you see. But what they did, which was the most repulsive thing, and I only because I have to humble myself from time to time, is they actually stood and sang to the men as they got on the bus. So whatever happens to the Boston chapter, c'est la vie, if you get my drift, because one measure of power, women, and this is always uncomfortable for women to hear, but the true measure of power is the ability to punish. Do you get it? It's not the few perks. But anyway, you will think about that tonight, because that's really a deep statement. But Angela, I was appalled at, and I say this because I have a theme that will run through, which is the sexism within my own community that we have to confront, those of us who are African-American women, especially those women of scholarship, especially those African-American women like Patricia Williams, you know, and others that really have to fight for our life, and you need to know this. It is the most insidious. Angela Davis and all the nationalist bookstores, soon as she came out against the Million Man March and Louis Farrakhan, they ripped her books out of the nationalist stores. They took her posters down. They started to talk about her lifestyle in the black press. They were the most vicious. I have never seen Angela, because Angela had never been booed by a black audience before, and these men were vicious. Now me, they could not touch me because I have been in their face clearly. I said, you know, Angela, if you recall, was freeing the Soledad brothers in the 60s. She was not freeing the Soledad sisters. Get it clear. This has been your quote-unquote comrade, and how dare you, if you respect her intellect and her leadership and her ideology, if she dares one time not to walk lockstep beside some ignorant promise keeper confusion. Remember the promise keepers, because I don't want you all to think that you all get off scot-free. It's a whole bunch of brawn with the promise keepers, too. They stand up and lock arms and try to look masculine and keep women home in the kitchen. Now, I enjoy cooking a great deal, and started a black gourmet club a long time ago. I like to dance on a lot. I don't want anybody to say they can do anything better than me. But you know I must make a fool of myself from time to time. But the reality is that I don't want, in my community, 50% of our leadership to be stripped from us, and right now it is. They would rather have a failed idiot. People marvel at, I'm so sick of hearing about how Louis Farrakhan was the only black man that could get a million people. Let me tell you what got a million men out, which made intelligent African women say stupid things, is because for 18 months we had to hear a 911 tape We had to watch Furman. We had to know about the code of silence. We had to be reminded through our historic memory of the racism of many courts through many southern towns where people came in and just murdered and hatcheted black women and children. Months of an O.J. Simpson confusion that drove some of us who know we don't, the issue of his guilt is a non-issue. We know he did it. But I don't know how many people Furman may have killed. And everybody's got an LAPD story that's black in America that's been through that godforsaken place. What got a million men together was Rodney King having his head bludgeoned in damn near, and we know that he wasn't working with all eight pistons to begin with, but that still does not suggest that one should be beaten like an animal. We know that he needed counseling and his own substance abuse and his abuse of his family and his friends and society, but that did not give anybody the excuse to beat his brains out. We saw Mike Tyson with his strange young self. We experienced Tupac Shakur with his vulgar, misguided self. I personally witnessed black leaders not smart enough to embrace these young black men. Don King is the one who should have gone to jail because he set up the little beauty pageant as if he was going to pick out bonbons. Which one do you want? It used to be in the black community, by the way, the NAACP and the Urban League protected our young people, so Tupac Shakur would have been to a council, would have been protected, would have been ensconced by bright people. So the rage of people, you could have had any idiot stand up, not Jesse Jackson, because he had spent himself. Nobody is going to follow Al Sharpton, who is a good friend of mine, but until he stops putting them curlers in his hair, nobody is going to follow Al. Now, let's be cool about it. I'm clear. And the venom and the hatred of Louis Farrakhan spoke to the very soul of people who had been barraged by negative imaging of African Americans when, in fact, African Americans today are 60% middle class. When in fact the issues of Appalachia are still issues that white folks don't talk about. That the voice of moral authority will still come from people of color, and that's okay, I like it, I think it's important. Barbara Jordan reminded us of that. So boundary crossing leadership is critically important. We've got to get smart and wise. We've got to stop trying to love each other. Do not patronize me with a million questions about where I went to school, unless you are willing to answer the same million questions about your family and folks. And then some of my biases may come out and some of my love may come out and some of our wisdom may gel and there may be a synergy between us and we may be able to write policy together. We may be able to inspire people to run for office. We may be able to buy some businesses in order to give some money back to create shelters for women who have been battered and abused. There are all kinds of terrific things that we can do, but we must be smart. We must know our history. We must understand our differences and celebrate those differences. I watched the water rise. I am trying to summate. It is a challenge. May I, Leslie, bow at this point? Did I do my time? Thank you.
I think that was one of the most biblically inspiring speeches we've ever had, courtesy of the Center for Research on Women. I hope the waters part as we leave. Thank you all for coming. I look forward to seeing you at many Women's Center events, and thank you so much.